You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
And we are welcoming another BFMer to the BFM bubble.
She's back.
Hey, it's Mary Margaret.
Hello.
How are you? Sarah. Oh, thank you.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mary Makareta toku ingoa no mai haere mai ki te wā mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Thursday the 7th of May, my first Wire back in the studio in far too long. I'm so pleased to be here. I was beaming all the way I was walking up Queen Street, which actually happens to be a lot nicer to hang out on when there's no cars. I was just walking all over it. I officially like Queen Street again. My name is Mary Margaret and I'm back with you now that it's level 3, so I'll be with you for the next hour here on 95BFM, guiding you through some COVID news, some Happier New Zealand Music Month news, and just some personal news. Pretty much all I did over lockdown was save up for a secondhand bike, and I'm now a proud owner of a pink Healing, an 80s model, so if you ever see me whizzing around on it, probably tell me to slow down because I've already had almost a couple of accidents. Now, I haven't heard from any of you guys in so long, not since Sarahui started, of course, but I'd love to hear how you're doing. So do give me a call today, 309-3879. I believe is the number to call if my memory is not failing yet. But moving to The Wire, FIRK&A on the show today. We, of course, hear from Andrew Little on topics from a trans-Tasman bubble, transparency and legal advice to government about the lockdown, and engaging with the cannabis referendum. An upcoming artist and musician, Hina, tells me about the importance of New Zealand Music Month to her and why we should fund wānanga and creative opportunities all year long. In Neighbourhood Watch, we are talking about Scott Morrison's last week during COVID-19, including a significant idea shared with our own Prime Minister. I'm recapping some questions about the fast-tracking of shovel-ready projects in a bill that some urban planners fear may jeopardise due democratic process. Jackie Clark is hosting a distanced fundraiser called 56 and Fierce for her organisation, The Aunties, and we are hearing today's Epidemic Response Committee notes, thanks to Connor and Isra. Tukupatu hi mai, text me on 5395. Why am I? Give us a call, 309-3879. And don't forget that all of these stories will be available in podcast on the 95BFM website. Without further ado, let's get into it.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Yes, we are indeed hearing from Justice Minister Andrew Little again on a range of topics. We started by talking about how much the government needs to make public when it comes to legal advice for decisions such as a national lockdown.
The Epidemic Response Committee will issue summonses to the Solicitor General, the Director General of Health, the Police Commissioner, after the committee's chair, Simon Bridges, said that there are concerns about the legal advice for our lockdown not being made public. Do you think that it's important for information such as this to be made public?
No, what's important is that when decisions are taken and decrees are promulgated, which is what has happened, is that the authority for it is clearly spelled out and what is required is clearly spelled out. All of that has happened in the health notice. The constitutional outrage that Simon Bridges is trying to effect is one where he's trying to place himself as not only a parliamentarian, but actually as a judge as well. If somebody's concerned about the powers that, for example, the police are exercising or that a medical officer of health are exercising, then the place to do that is to challenge that in court, and there have already been court challenges on this. Mm. And it's a judge to decide whether or not the law has been applied. The role of parliamentarians is as lawmakers. We make the law, but then we have an independent branch of government called the judiciary that then interprets the law and decides whether or not it has been complied with or properly adhered to. Simon Bridges is completely confusing his role and the role of that committee. And look, there's never been a situation where the Crown has divulged the legal advice on which ministers have acted. And largely because if there is a legal challenge, like any other party to court, you know, you're entitled to maintain the confidentiality of your legal advice. I mean, he ought to know that because he's a former lawyer and Crown prosecutor. So this is a stunt on his part. It's a game playing. It's unfortunate that he's allowed things to descend to that sort of level, but you know, he's looking for every headline that he can get.
The Otago University law professor, Andrew Geddes, sort of echoed your concerns, saying that the concern for him centres around precedent in terms of accessibility of Parliament to government's legal advice. I sort of understand this in terms, you know, of our political system being one that upholds the separation of powers. What do you make of this and of his concerns?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the Parliamentary Committee, and it has been set up, it was dominated by the opposition for a very good purpose, is that they're to scrutinise what happened and ask questions, and some questions that, you know, are difficult that the government might not want to have asked, but that's what a proper accountability looks like. But that is the role of Parliament, to provide that scrutiny. But it's not the role of Parliament to get in behind the legal advice that Solicitor General provides to any Minister of the Crown, because you know, the Crown has to take action, and if there is a legal challenge, the Crown is entitled to resort to the legal advice that it has got, and that is the basis on which the Crown will defend itself in any legal action. But you don't disclose that in advance. And, you know, the legal system has always recognised the notion of legal privilege, that is to say that the advice that you get when you're taking action that has consequences for others is privileged to you, that is to say it is confidential to you. So this is an attempt to erode that principle. It should be looked at with considerable concern.
Obviously, you are upholding the fact that there does need to be scrutiny, because it is important for governments to be held accountable. Do you think that scrutiny should come down more to the advice given by public health experts about the necessity of preemptive shutdowns?
Yeah, we looked around the rest of the world and saw what was happening, saw those who had not responded in a very kind of effective way, had not taken the sort of measures that we were being advised to take. And that was the advice to us was very clear, that the health advice was very clear, which is, we don't know the characteristics of this virus. It looks very contagious. Mm. It's a new virus, so it's actually, you don't really know for some months until you know the true characteristics of it. But it's contagious. It's moving rapidly. It was in a lot of countries by the time we started taking action. It's in pretty much every country now. And we were told this is what we can predict, and therefore to avoid this, to avoid mass kind of casualties, including fatalities, these are the measures that you have to take. And so we did that. Now, we did that. That was the health advice. We got legal advice as well. We've indicated that our decisions are based on our rights or the rights of the Crown under the Health Act, as well as the Triple Defence and Emergency Management Act. And for parliamentarians who are offering scrutiny, that's what they need to know. What was the statutory power that you claimed to use? Does it meet that? But it is not the right of parliament to say, and now we want your legal advice that we'll expose to all the world. Because the Crown has to be able to defend itself.
Okay. Now, discussing the way that this highly contagious virus affected other countries, we, once safe to do so, have an idea of a trans-Tasman bubble. Now, I've seen some response to this idea as people not wanting to share travel and the risk of transmission with Australia. So what about this idea makes it a priority for the government?
I think, well, Australia and New Zealand are two countries that have followed a very similar path. I mean, I think Australia is still suffering a greater number of casualties and probably a slightly higher proportion. But in terms of responses, certainly at the state level, they've been very similar to what New Zealand has done. So the incident has been very small, and I think there is a sense that both countries are saying, you know, if we get to the point where we are confident that the virus is well under control, and the risk is very minimal, then at that point we could look at opening up our borders. Now, it won't be wholesale, because I think even Australia is saying, look, the only safe place at the moment would be Tasmania, because there's still problems in New South Wales and Victoria. So I think while there was a desire to do so, the utmost precaution would be taken, because neither country, in fact, no country wants to make things worse, but neither of it, New Zealand or Australia, who've kind of managed this reasonably well, want to risk further outbreaks and having to, you know, potentially move back up alert levels and so on.
Of course. Now, moving to our final two topics, I noticed that the Human Rights Commission has received such an elevation of complaints related to the COVID-19 pandemic, which means this has been the most serious human rights emergency Aotearoa has experienced since 1945. And they say that discrimination against those who are Chinese in our community has heightened far and away more than anything else. I know that you and I have discussed before the fact that pandemics highlight pre-existing inequities, and I wondered if you agree that protecting groups from harassment such as this should be a measure of healthcare that is more robust all of the time and increasingly available in times such as this.
Yeah, definitely, and that is really disappointing to see, and good on the Human Rights Commission for calling that out, because they are, you know, they get a lot of complaints, but we also know that for every complaint they get, there'll be probably, you know, half a dozen to a dozen more where people just, you know, they feel so disempowered, they don't know what to do, they won't do anything about it. And we've seen in other countries too a similar thing, that it's become, that the COVID-19 thing has become a reason to take out people's prejudices and racism against other communities, and particularly Asian communities, and especially the Chinese community. Mm. And there is, you know, we need to call that out wherever we can, I think. I know that the police, in terms of their responses to things, they've indicated to me that they've had situations where they've observed racist comments being made to members of the Chinese community, and that's just totally unacceptable. This is not, you know, members of the Chinese community here are not responsible for this, you know, worldwide health pandemic, and you know, people should not be seeking to blame. This is something we've all got to deal with. There is always a risk of pandemic in the modern world, and that's life, and we deal with it, and this is the way we're dealing with it, but we don't go around being racist and prejudiced about it.
Now, the fact that we've reached level 3, I feel it is in some ways easier to envision some of the changes that a lot of us have been arguing were necessary throughout the time of Rahui. For myself, this has kind of meant thinking more about how we might approach the cannabis referendum in particular this year. And I know that you've said that the public should feel like they can meaningfully participate in the referendum as well as the other ones that we're having this year. So I'd like to just have a quick conversation about the engagement with referendums being important and the impact that complacency around them has on polarising referendums such as ones this year.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the two referendum questions we've got are two quite significant questions, the one about end-of-life choice and the other about legalising marijuana. So these are big steps to take in terms of social policy. And we should all be thinking very carefully about it. You know, people do have the right to have a vote and elect the government, but they also have a right to have a say on these things. And these, although the end-of-life choice in particular has been thoroughly debated in Parliament, nevertheless, it's down to the electorate now to decide whether, you know, we want our country to take this step. Other countries have done it. And people have to weigh up. Is this, you know, does this empower people? Does it give people a greater sense of dignity that once they're in a position where they're terminally ill, they've lost a lot of bodily function, they have lost their dignity in the sense of who they are, even though they're of sound mind, you know, should they be able to make a decision to bring forward the time of their death. And people bring religious values to that and various other views, but we need to have a good public debate about it. On cannabis, you know, the argument there is this is a substance that's been absolutely prohibited for 50-odd years. It is around. It is around in significant numbers. The current arrangements are having negative health effects. You know, young people are getting access to it when desirably they shouldn't be. We don't have any real education about it, about its impact on people and how to use it sensibly. And here's an opportunity to change the settings we have around cannabis so that it can be a substance, even though it can cause harm, that can be used safely in the community. So we should make inquiries, find out. There will be all sorts of voices. Some of them will be, in my view, irrational. They'll be moralistic. Others will be looking at the science and the medicine of it. And we should listen to that and make up a judgment. Is there a better way to manage this substance that we know right now at the time of absolute prohibition is causing harm? Can we minimise that harm by doing things differently?
Yeah. It's really exciting that we have that opportunity to see what positive drug education could look like, hey?
Yeah, and that's the thing, I think. It's an opportunity, if we can strip it of its criminal stigma, to then actually have a real good education about it, educate young people, say, look, here's the thing. Actually, if you really want to experiment with it, your time is a little bit later in your life. You know, wait till you're in your 20s, it'll be safer for you because the risks are too great when you're younger. So it's not about saying don't, but it's about saying here's a safe way to consume this. And look, if, you know, there's a bunch of factors that you might have, that some of which might say if you've got these factors, then actually you probably shouldn't be looking at this. Mm-hmm. But you know, giving people the information and empowering them to make good decisions about their own health. That's really what we want.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
That was indeed Minister Andrew Little. You're on 95BFM and I'll be back after these messages.
This is a COVID-19 announcement. Helpline for businesses. There is now a free helpline service for all New Zealand businesses. It can offer you specific advice and access to government-funded business support, advice on what Alert Level 3 means for your business, general business advice and access to online resources and webinars, and connections to business advisory services. Call 0800 500 362 to find out more.
Sorry, no goths.
Excuse me?
Yeah, piss off. Maybe without those sunnies you could read the bloody sign.
No goths? This is cruel and unusual.
Not as cruel and unusual as that beautiful velvet cape. Now get out of my sight, Nosferatu.
I'm a human being.
It's hard out there for a goth, but everyone's welcome on Penny's 1-4. A heady mix of the sounds of now and the shimmering hits from our alternative past. With Penny, every Monday only on 95BFM.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Welcome back to Te Wire. I'm your host, Mary Margaret, and it's just gone 20 past 12. We're going now to a story that I'm really excited about. Long-time listeners will know that I love reporting on some more artsy stories, reporting on shows and sort of what the message is behind it is. But this is actually a profile of a new artist who's getting involved in producing and releasing in time for Music Month, the first ever locked down one. Her name is Hina, and we talked all about deciding to embark on creative professions in Aotearoa and the importance of funding wānanga to foster these opportunities all year long.
Let's start by talking about the meaning of Hina and why you decided to go by that when you're making music.
Well, I've always had kind of this makes me sound like a bit of a weirdo, but I've always felt really like connected to the moon in terms of like how it affects, well, I guess it's like intimately connected with women's, do I say that on the radio, menstrual cycle, which is like quite a, I don't know, it's quite a special thing. Like in Te Ao Māori, it's called Awa Atua, I hope I got that right, but it's like the river that connects us all and connects us to the gods, and like the moon sort of governs that. So I was thinking about a name for ages, and I just couldn't start on it. And then I was like, maybe I should just use Amy. And then I was like, kind of want some pseudo anonymity. So yeah, chose Hina as like sort of like it's a personification of the moon, I suppose, that's known throughout Polynesia. So it gives me that local flavor, which kind of wanted to go for.
You took part in a web series on Māori television profiling a group of rangatahi who were learning about making music professionally. Was that kind of process like wider than just the music itself, you know, the art that accompanies the music that you make and all of that? And how much did it sort of influence your decision to name yourself Hina?
It actually influenced it a lot. It's interesting you bring that up because it's probably like I've sort of been getting to know my place within Te Ao Māori over the course of maybe 5 or 6 years, because obviously grew up in like a predominantly Pākehā world. But yeah, so that kind of made me, well, it was like the push that I guess I needed to actually consider doing music seriously rather than just like bumming around in my bedroom, which I still do anyway, but like with more purpose now. So it kind of felt right to incorporate a Māori name, given that it was like a Māori launching platform, if that makes sense. Yeah. But, yeah, no, that was, yeah, Papapa was so, so fun. It was like we did heaps more than, well, it felt like we did heaps more than just focus on music. Like we had 4 wānanga and just like learned about the business side of it, learned about how we sort of just relate to each other as people as well, like trying to write songs together and you suddenly, you know, come across a part of yourself that you're like, holy shit, do I share this with people or do I just like cry about it in the bathroom? Yeah, it was a like really, to use your word, holistic learning process.
I have also found ways in which when you're part of a cohesive like resource or organ that is comprised of other people, you start to think in terms of them and what you're putting out as opposed to thinking in terms of yourself. Do you think that that process was kind of important in your decision to start producing and releasing music this year?
Yeah, definitely. Because when you feel like you're part of a community, you feel like you're just contributing to that community, and it sort of feels a bit safer in a way, like you've got like a net. Yeah, so it's like when I chuck something up on Instagram, I'm not like, oh my God, the world's looking at me, but I'm just like, oh, like my mates can check this out, who actually, yeah, sort of went along the, I hate using the word journey because it's so overused, but like a musical journey for them. Like, yeah, so it feels a bit more supported.
Yeah. And on that note about community, I wonder what New Zealand Music Month means to you, both in terms of this year when we probably need community more than ever, but just also as a legacy that we always knew about growing up.
So for New Zealand Music Month, I guess it feels a bit more poignant this year, I think, just because at least in terms of gigs and stuff, there's, well, we can't go to any. And then for the foreseeable future, I guess no one can really come to New Zealand either. So it's sort of like a different type of celebration. Like even the Tate Music Prize was like online last night. It's kind of shown how the music industry can adapt. Like I don't actually know much about other creative industries, but I've been getting so many emails from like Creative NZ industries and like MMF, like the Music Managers Forum and stuff, being like, this is all the support we can give you, this is what we can do to help. And it's just like, whoa, dude, that's awesome.
So on a wider note about COVID-19, you know, Ārahui definitely, I'm guessing, wasn't the environment that you anticipated you'd be releasing your first EP into. Has it changed your production or wider approach to your EP and first debut at all?
Well, it's had a mixed effect. So I've been able to uni and work and stuff. I'm just like at home. So I've had loads of time to have Zoom meetings with various people in the industry who have been able to give me advice and stuff. And I just feel like that's been really awesome to have technology at my fingertips to just chat with people whenever. Because I feel like sometimes having to find parks in Auckland is deterring enough as to like, you know, meeting with people. But in terms of output, it feels a bit strange only because I haven't released anything ever. So it's like I'm putting it out into this, to the ears of people I hope are still listening and haven't just like totally gotten sick of the internet and listening to new music that everyone seems to be releasing at the moment.
Yeah.
I'm just, yeah, fingers crossed.
And it is sort of a mixed experience being part of Ārahui and whatever form that takes, but it has given rise to new ideas like E Noho, which was the live stream music show. It was made by Ed Walker, wasn't it?
Yes.
And you performed on that. So I wondered, sometimes, you know, big shifts such as this can be kind of important refreshers for things like New Zealand Music Month, like we've talked about. Did E Noho feel like that at all when you took part?
Yeah, it certainly was different from a live gig because obviously it was just like me and Ed on, I can't remember what it was actually called, the platform, but it was basically like Zoom. So I was like, I was just performing to him and I couldn't actually see any of the like comments or reactions on Facebook. But it felt really, it was a positive experience overall, like despite not being able to, I guess, get out there physically and gig. It's a pretty special little thing he's pulled together, which is, yeah, it was so cool to be a part of.
Shout out where we'll be able to find your music when it is out in just over a month.
My music will be available on Spotify and Apple Music and possibly some other platforms. So at Hina Beaming, H-I-N-A, of my Instagram, online party that I'm having by myself.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That was Hina telling me about being a new artist during lockdown New Zealand Music Month. She's always been a special wahine to me throughout my life, so I'm really excited to hear her release more things. And I do recommend that you keep your ears peeled. But now...
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
We are going across the ditch now to catch up with Zoe Kanatis about her week during COVID, in which the idea of a trans-Tasman bubble is taking off.
Both our Prime Ministers have agreed to, when it's safe to do so, commence a trans-Tasman travel bubble.
Yeah, I do like this idea of a little bubble, travel bubble.
Is it quite popular over there? Is the idea being well received?
I think so. I mean, we have a huge number of people from New Zealand living here, vice versa, I kind of believe. So it feels like a nice little connection with the outside world, doesn't it?
It
sounds busy, but it's sort of nice to partner up with another country and maybe soon be able to travel between the two.
Mm. What kind of other updates have happened this week with Scott Morrison and COVID-19 in general in Australia?
So we are seeing a lot of states in Australia, not just South Australia, places like the Northern Territory, I think Western Australia, numbers are quite low and cases are deteriorating. As I mentioned, there's only 2 active cases, I believe, that we know of in South Australia. We had a press conference of a sort of soft reopening of some states, no borders opening, but things like pubs or gyms and making soft plans there to see how we can kind of reopen again back to a new normal. We have this week have our wage subsidy JobKeeper payment coming in for a lot of people. There has been a lot of calls from businesses trying to ask the government to allow this payment to be available to casuals, as they're finding that we have millions of people who are casually employed, and businesses are finding that these savings and they would be able to pay their casuals. But the Treasurer has made it quite clear that that's probably not going to go forward.
Last week I asked about Scott Morrison and a push for an inquiry internationally into the origins of COVID-19. Let's revisit this. Over the last week, what has the reception been to what he describes as a sensible course of action?
There's been a mixed reaction to this inquiry. Obviously, Prime Minister Scott Morrison is saying that it is a sensible thing to do, and he's saying he would like to have this inquiry in order to find out where it's come from and make sure and prevent it from happening again, and so that we can learn the lesson of a global pandemic. That is his reasoning behind this inquiry into China. However, China and Australia has such a complex relationship that you could read 20 million articles about it and still not be fully across it. But essentially, we rely on each other very heavily economically. You know, it's not just Australia buying our supplies from China. We do export to China as well. And a lot of business owners, a few billionaires here in Australia have voiced concern over this inquiry, and we have seen the Chinese ambassador to Australia kind of put a little bit of a threat forward, saying that any inquiry will cause some sort of economic backlash, and has gone as far to say that there could be sort of a threat of consumer boycott of Australian goods if this inquiry was to be pushed further ahead. which has a few people worrying. But we also see this side where people aren't too concerned about this sort of political, diplomatic, not fight or feud, but we don't know if it's going to spill over economically, if we are going to have to worry about that.
Mm. I mean, if the inquiry does go ahead and gain traction internationally and the economic consequences were to come to fruition, would it be seen sort of as an opportunity for Australia to reconfigure its economic management, or not really?
No, there has been talk of that as well. Is this, we sort of, for lack of a better term, lose China or lose this economic relationship with them, that it would incite a need for Australia to have to figure it out on our own feet, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to say when the numbers are so high of what we are getting from China. So things like medicine, electric goods, and this, that, the other. There's such a list that it does seem, it seems quite gigantic to think that as a country we would be able to do that.
Yeah.
But there has been talk of it, and, you know, I'm not totally across the business, manufacturing, economic world, so I can't really say whether it could or couldn't be done, but it has got some people worried and got some people thinking, what do we do if we lose this economic relationship with China?
So I found it interesting that Mr. Morrison's angle is predominantly one of the world needing to learn from the outbreak. He says the independent inquiry as a means of doing this. However, my country's justice minister told me this morning he believes that pandemics are natural and sort of ever-present risks. Do you think that comprehensive healthcare is another sensible course of action that he believes should be learnt or might be learnt from the outbreak?
In terms of this idea of being able to be prepared for a pandemic, one that we see so many countries admitting that we definitely weren't prepared for this. I don't think anyone was. And to have this, I guess Scott Morrison wants to be able to prevent such a pandemic from ever happening again.
Mm.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was Zoe Kanatis from Radio Adelaide. Coming back to New Zealand now, Cabinet has agreed to a law change that will block the public from the resource consent process in order to fast-track projects. I understand that this could be cause for concern given the importance of public input, so I got in touch with Karen Blair, the Principal Planning Consultant at Foresight Consultancy in Victoria Park. I asked her in an email if fast-tracking consents could jeopardise a considerably important democratic process. She told me, not necessarily. In theory, fast-tracking consents is simply a process that enables a consent to be issued quickly and in a different manner than would ordinarily occur. The consent itself might end up being the same or potentially more onerous than a consent issued by a council in accordance with the existing process. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the democratic process won't be upheld. That said, I acknowledge there is always going to be a perception by some parties that they are at risk of being denied when something out of the ordinary, such as fast-tracking consent, occurs. I then told Karen that I'd read the amendment will minimise the scope of fast-track projects that are non-controversial. So I asked what kind of projects non-controversial ones are. She told me that the signal is that a limited number of large government-led projects would be listed in the bill and be able to use the new process automatically, and that ministerial approval would otherwise be required for projects to use this process. The current indication is that this would include projects that would alleviate housing challenges and build more houses, encourage active transport, roading, walking, cycling, rail, and enhance the environment, sediment removal from silted rivers and estuaries, new wetland constructions, flood management works, and projects to prevent landfill erosion. It will be really important that the government chooses its projects carefully, as clearly not all large projects will be suitable for the new process. Removing public input, for example, Karen says, on projects which are inherently controversial or would impact on private property rights would obviously invite legal challenge related to the process or the outcomes. this sort of defeats the purpose in legislation. I think that this legislation is mostly likely to benefit projects where there are no issues as to property rights, where the adverse effects are clear and can be appropriately managed, and there's an environmental benefit and an accessible labour market. In short, this is likely to be projects that are neither controversial nor likely lead to environmentally and or economically unsound decisions. To do otherwise risks the perverse outcome whereby consents are fast-tracked but subsequently delayed via some form of legal challenge. Finally, I asked Karen if the current system of public input functions well, arguably. And she explained that like any system, whether it functions well will depend on what your expectations are from it and how good the inputs are into it. In terms of consents, Karen can't recall the percentage across the country that are fully publicly notified, but it's definitely not high, she says. Many more consents have some form of limited notification, for example, to neighbours or iwi groups. There is a balance, and like anything that requires discretion to be applied and a decision to be made, some people will say yes, it works well, and others will say no, it doesn't. And the answer to that is likely to change depending on whether and how someone is personally affected by a project. I guess that's why I believe, says Karen, that the inclination will be for non-controversial projects to be fast-tracked, but it's not yet clear how that will be determined. Will a project be deemed controversial because it's likely to attract some loud voices to the table, she wonders. Of course, all this begs the question, why can't the existing system actually be efficiently used to produce robust consents for non-controversial projects without the need to take the process out of the hands of councils or to specifically prevent public input? On that front, I would suggest that perhaps this process suggests the government at least doesn't think the existing system of public input functions well. The fact that it's looking to significantly reform the Resorts Management Act is further evidence of that. We will be back after a short break with some EDC updates. Thank you to Karen for all of that input, and do give me a call about that topic. I personally think it's quite an interesting one, and I'm probably going to talk to the Justice Minister, if not the Environment Minister, in weeks to come, because that's definitely going to develop more. We'll be back after this. You're on 95BFM. Thank you.
daily epidemic response committee update on 95BFM.
We are indeed back with today's epidemic response committee notes. Thanks to Connor and Isra this morning. We heard that as the country continues to stay in lockdown level three, we are hearing from a range of sporting organisations, including Netball New Zealand, the New Zealand Rugby Players Association, as well as the Exercise Association of New Zealand, which represents gyms. Cameron George, the Chief Executive of the Warriors, will also make an appearance. Jenna Wiley from Netball New Zealand discusses a funding solution to help support the loss of revenue now and years to come. She goes on to discuss how women's sports have always been at a disadvantage from the start, so an immediate support package is needed now more than ever to get them back on their feet. Richard Betty from the Exercise Association of New Zealand joins the committee to discuss the effects of lockdown on gyms nationwide. It has been said that as the country moves into level two lockdown, gyms will reopen. However, precautionary measures will be taken to ensure public safety. He discusses the long-term implications that gyms will experience when they reopen, which will bring down membership levels from 80 to 50% due to financial and social fears. Due to the public's lack of attendance at gyms, this could mean that some facilities may face bankruptcy and the fear of having to close down. Now, the New Zealand Rugby Players Association Chief Executive Rob Nichols says for Olympic athletes, the mental impact on the cancellation has been the largest challenge, and a big obstacle is to get athletes motivated to work towards a new goal after having the Olympics cancelled. He says it's very important that the athletes are given certainty going forward. I'm just going to interject with a silly little thing I saw on Twitter of a swimmer practicing swimming at her in quarantine at home, and she was sort of lying on this bench doing backstroke and freestyle, and she looked very impressive. So anyway, that's most of my input on these epidemic committee notes. Moving on, Nichols says he's hopeful professional sport can come back at level two with contact tracing, temperature monitoring, and heightened medical monitoring for players in terms of community sport. He says it requires planning and preparation so that players can participate in a safe and managed way. Steph Bond of the NZ Rugby Players Association echoed that it's important women's sport is not left behind in this recovery. She says there's been significant growth in participation pre-COVID, and it's important that this continues as part of the recovery rather than men's sports being the sole focus. Totoko, as not a sports player, but someone who's started running a lot in the lockdown again. I hope everyone else was too. It's been a nice opportunity to sort of get back to the rudiments, and now I just look forward to going for a walk or a run on a sunny day. Anyway.
That was your EDC update on 95BFM.
That was indeed our update. Thank you very much to Connor and Isra. We're going to finish now with a story from Jackie Clark of the Aunties, who is promoting a fun little fundraiser that she's got going on tomorrow. Let's find out more.
What's happening tomorrow is that every year on my birthday, I have a bit of a fundraising campaign, and instead of saying happy birthday to me, people bung money in the bank account or whatever. And this year, I thought since the formal Friday thing was a go, and also we want to carry on doing the fruit and veg boxes, so we were given money by Yellow to get fruit and veg boxes to all the Aunties whānau, the 30 women in that particular group. But that money ran out, so we're still doing it, but with somebody different. Cash injection to keep on doing that, and so that's what all the funds are going towards. And I thought, yeah, we'll just reinstate formal Friday just for my birthday, and I'll even get glammed up and fucking put lipstick on, for fuck's sake. And shit, which is like, I woke up at 4:30 this morning, so I'm like lying in bed right now. I'm not feeling very glam at all. And just to raise money, really, just a birthday thing, just a bit of a gimmick, you know, a bit of a good selling point, and people like to do it every year. And people have loved lockdown formal Friday, and Hillary Barry said she'd win the tiara, so yeah.
Awesome. And how can people get involved? Can they glam up with you, and where should they send their money to?
So basically, I will have the links on Twitter and our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/refugeaunties. And the Twitter account is aunties_the, but you can check that out. And yeah, they can, or they can put money now, give a little, which is givealittle.co.nz /org/theaunties. Yeah, and just do it like that and make some money in. But post a selfie of yourself either on Twitter and hashtag it 56 and fierce.
Ah, 56 and fierce.
That's my little hashtag.
Yeah. And just to finish, I walked past a sign today. It's the first sign I've seen of this kind in COVID. It said, be kind, take care of the vulnerable. Do you want to say a little bit about the importance of donating, especially to your local refuges, if you can?
Well, you know, what I want to say about this is that, and I've kind of had this discussion before with some of the women who, you know, see so many, and members of their family are very vulnerable in terms of either poverty or domestic violence, but for whatever reason they haven't reached out to anybody yet and nobody's kind of reached into them effectively, and the girls say, we're really lucky to have you. And I understand that for the people who do know about the aunties and do seek support and use us as a resource, you know, that's a really great thing, but we can't, we're a tiny organisation and we can't do that for everybody. And that's what I think, you know, if you're particularly, if this is around domestic violence, then people really need to support their local refuges, because refuge organisations have such, they do such a good job and they have extensive wraparound services.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for another day. Rāpare Thursday, the 7th of May. Beginning of New Zealand Music Month. Beginning of a real cold snap. I hope the sun stays out. It's so pretty at the moment. I feel like I'm back in London, but we won't go into it because that's all I ever talk about on the radio. It's so nice to be back. Thank you all for tuning in and listening to me, even though I was bumbling and more nervous than I usually am. Thank you to everyone texting in some articles. These all look really interesting and I'm definitely going to check these out. I'll catch you next week. In the meantime, a big thank you to everyone who came on my show today. I had Justice Minister Andrew Little, Amy Borovitch, also known as Hina Music, Zoe Kanatis of Radio Adelaide. Thanks also to Isra and Connor for their notes of the Epidemic Committee. Thank you to Karen Blair from Foresight for sharing all her knowledge with me. That was really interesting to learn about. Do get behind Jackie Clark and 56 and Fierce. It's for a really good cause, and all of those organisations deserve those funds because they really do the mahi in helping those who we need. And a final thank you always to the favourite people in my life, Lillian Hanley and Sarah Thompson. I'm Mary Margaret and I'll be with you again next week. Stay safe, ka kite anō.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.